Film Spotting is brought to you by the all-new PeerFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at PeerFlix.com.
And by StompThePodcast.com. Get the inside tracks on stomp life and culture and the street-style stomp dance moves that evolved in the urban community. Step up to stomp culture and life at StompThePodcast.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Happy holidays and happy new year, everyone. Coming up on this week's show, Sam, our last show of 2006,
show.
Massacre Theater, music from Bottle Rockets, and a look back at the best performances of the year. We recently highlighted our favorite supporting players on our podcast. Now it's time to reveal our top five lead actors and actresses. We've also got reviews of two of the most hyped films of the holiday season, Clint Eastwood's Letters from Iwo Jima and Dreamgirls.
Dina's gonna sing lead.
What do you mean? I always sing lead.
We're your dream girls.
Ow! Boy. Change. I'm talking change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're your dream girls.
I promise you I was gonna make you a star, right?
We'll always care.
You can't have it all, baby.
Despite Chicago's Best Picture win back in 2002, it still feels a little anachronistic to see a big-time, big-budget, big-star Hollywood adaptation of a Broadway musical. Back in the early 80s, Henry Krieger and Don Ayen's Dreamgirls, a fictionalized account of the rise of Motown Records, and in particular Diana Ross in The Supremes, ran for over 1,500 performances and won 6 Tony Awards. The new film version is written and directed by Bill Condon, who adapted Chicago for the screen, and stars Beyoncé Knowles, and that's Beyoncé if you're nasty, Adam, Jamie Foxx, Eddie Murphy, and in a performance that is unanimously being touted as the film standout, American Idol veteran and Chicago native Jennifer Hudson. Adam, you and I recently brushed up on our Candor and Ebb and our Kernan Fields and our Bernstein and Sondheim with a six-week musicals marathon, and in addition to seeing several classic musicals for the first time, the great pleasure of the marathon was in discovering for ourselves some of the great musical performers. Steren Rogers in Swing Time, Gene Kelly in An American in Paris, Liza Minnelli and Joel Grey in Cabaret. And unlike the Oscar-winning Chicago, which starred Renee Zellweger, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Richard Gere, Dreamgirls features performers that are actually known as much for their voices as for their acting chops. I mean, even Eddie Murphy, you want to sing along with me here?
My girl likes to party all the time.
So tell me, does this make a difference? And if so, is Dreamgirls greater than the sum of its performances? Is this a musical to make us remember the great musicals of old?
Is this a musical to make us remember the great musicals of old?
That sounds like a
song. Question. Yeah, it is a great question. And as much as I hate to derail the Dreamgirls hype train, I'm going to get to it right off the bat here, Sam. The answer is actually yes, but not because it belongs in that same company as the musicals you mentioned, but because it made me remember just how great those musicals were and how little, I have to say, I ended up enjoying this film. And I'll give you an idea.
I have to say I'm grateful.
Are you?
That you're stepping out here first.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you an idea of my experience with this film. And of course, as you know, we don't hand out star ratings during our reviews by design, but this film for me began as a surefire four-star movie, maybe even a five-star
movie. Meaning you liked it a lot.
I liked it a lot. I loved the style of it, the frenetic pace, the editing, and the music. The entire talent show sequence that kicks off the film,
yeah,
I thought was great, culminating really with my favorite moment in the entire film, which is where Eddie Murphy as James Thunder Early is teaching the Dreamettes, Beyoncé and Jennifer Hudson, and I'm never going to be able to say that actress's name right. So the three girls who are the Dreamettes, he's teaching them their first song backstage. It's Fake Your Way to the Top. And then in one swift motion, the curtain rises and they're on stage performing.
You're right. That first opening sequence is fantastic.
Yeah.
And everything builds. Like, I loved how the first sequence, the first people that perform, they're great.
Right.
They're really good. And I'm just like, this movie has it right because, and once the Dreamettes get on stage, they're blowing everyone else away. And it's like, wow, they have raised the bar here.
They deliver. And then when the headliner comes on, you're right. He is even better than everyone we've seen, as he should be. He's a professional. And that sequence, though, I mean, bravura filmmaking, I think, where it goes and, like I said, the camera moves and all of a sudden we've switched and we're in front of a live audience. Really just fantastic. Then the movie goes on and it's starting to dip to a three-star movie. I'm still enjoying it, but, you know, I have to be honest, I'm starting to feel that everything is just redundant. The songs aren't as interesting. The characters are thinly drawn. And, you know, I'm starting to feel like everybody's trapped in a music video. And by the end, it's lost me completely. And it's a two-star movie. I mean, not only are the songs not interesting, but I actually wanted them to stop, I have to say. You know, and it made me think of a movie we watched during our Screwball Comedies marathon, Bringing Up Baby, which I know everyone
relentless.
Kind of universally adores, but you know, I found monotonous and you know, overbearing in the gags and the dialogue. And I think I likened it to a pep band just blaring at you for 90 minutes. Well, with this film, I think I can explain why I don't think the songs work, but I want you to jump in and, and share your thoughts. But the last thing I will say, the one part of this film that does definitely live up to the hype, I think, is Jennifer Hudson as Effie White. She's really the leader of the group at first, of the Dreamettes, and gets pushed aside so Dina, Beyonce, can be the star. And when the movie loses her, the movie really lost me.
You know, it's so interesting. You're absolutely right. And I will say that right off the bat. I think that this movie does offer audiences an opportunity to experience something they're not going to have with other movies. And that, I know I had that experience. I don't know if you did, but when Jennifer Hudson sings that song, and I'm telling you I'm not going, the crowd broke into applause.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but you're just not going to get that anywhere else. So if that's what you're looking for, that kind of experience, I absolutely recommend it. And I've talked to a lot of other people, and I think maybe that alone is enough.
Maybe.
To, it's like the rest of the movie doesn't matter in a way, because
that
it's such
be,
a unique experience.
Yeah, that has to be the show-stopping moment, and it is, but maybe
absolutely
it comes too early in the film.
Maybe. It comes very early in the film. And I have to say, too, I mean, and I want to get that out. Jennifer Hudson, not only is she, and this is how she's good, every time she opened her mouth, I had chills. And when she was singing that song, I was near tears, just out of the sheer exhilaration of her performing. That's despite the fact that I think it was staged and shot and edited in every way to undermine her performances. I mean, Jennifer Hudson is a professional singer now. I know she started as an amateur, she started on American Idol, but she's a performer, just like a lot of these other actors at Beyonce. These are performers. These are people that are used to performing in front of audiences. Why do you need this is a standout, this is a breathtaking song experience, and there are probably 45 shots. It's edited and edited and edited, and the staging of it doesn't even make any sense. I mean, okay, she's singing to an empty audience as Jamie Foxx walks away, but it just isn't theatrical. It's not not anything. And I feel like the rest of the movie is like that. You brought up the point. It's a music video. And I have to say, as good as Jennifer Hudson's voice is, you don't give an Oscar or an Oscar nomination to a voice. I mean, it's moving, but her acting, just like everybody else's acting, is the equivalent of the acting you'd see in a music video.
Well, that's where I disagree with you. But I think she's better than that.
I think
you're
she's
right.
good, but more often than not, I think she's very good. She's effective, but it's more like striking a pose, striking an attitude. And she's totally effective in the role, but I don't see it as the kind of acting that we're going to be comparing it to with some of the other performances we've seen.
Well, where I'll agree with you is with Eddie Murphy, who's getting a lot of hype and could get an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor. And really, I loved watching him perform as Thunder early, but he doesn't have enough to do in any dramatic scenes other than performing for me to warrant consideration in that way. But I have to say, Jennifer Hudson, I disagree with you. I thought she was good in all the scenes where she's not singing. And of course, when she is singing, she's fantastic. But she was the only performer for me in the entire film who didn't feel to me like she was playing dress up and acting like a Broadway performer.
I'll mention one other name.
Impersonating someone else.
And that's Danny Glover.
Danny Glover, you're right.
Because Danny Glover,
those were the two.
I was reminded of how good Danny Glover always is in every film. And I honestly feel like he was the only person that was giving a performance like you're used to seeing in film.
No, I think those two, I agree with you completely. I said it to someone on the way here to record, actually, that Danny Glover, along with Jennifer Hudson, were the only two for
me. I mean, it made
me
think, like, has this guy ever been nominated for an Oscar? Maybe The Color Purple 20 years ago?
No, he's really good, and he's only in the movie for a little bit. But, you know, Beyonce is trying to be Diana Ross and trying to kind of live up to maybe something she grew up listening to, Dreamgirls. And here, you know, Eddie Murphy is channeling James Brown and Little Richard and a lot of other people. So, you know, for me, she was the only one that really felt real. I absolutely bought her as Effie White the entire time.
You're
not
right,
just someone striking a pose, as you said. I really bought her. But, you know, again, you mentioned off the top these great musicals. And you're right. We kind of had this little film school in these musicals. And the reason why, you know, the music in American in Paris and Swing Time and Cabaret, they're so good. And the problem with this film is that those songs can stand on their own outside of the film. And these songs can't. The lyrics are so on the nose in this movie. I couldn't believe it. They don't add any color, you know, or context to what a character is thinking or feeling. They just say it. Exactly. It's like, what's on the character's mind? I'm going to tell you verbatim. You know, there's no subtext to the songs at all. And then they just aren't really good songs, unfortunately. There's nothing for me that I'd listen to outside of the film.
Right.
Whereas those previous films I mentioned, I'd listen to I Got Rhythm. I'd listen to anything from Swing Time. And certainly Cabaret has some great songs that I'd listen to. But here, other than Fake Your Way to the Top, Eddie Murphy's big showstopper, and then And I'm Telling You I'm Not Going, which you mentioned, Jennifer Hudson, those are the two highlights of the film by far. And other than that, I don't think any of the songs are really memorable, which when you're watching a musical, which is almost wall-to-wall music, that's a problem.
That's a big problem. And I think it's interesting, too, and I'm sure this has been explained and defended probably when the music came out, but it's interesting that you're telling a story that is about music losing its soul.
Mm-hmm.
With songs that are steadily losing their soul throughout the
world.
Right. And it's an interesting problem. It's an interesting narrative problem that they don't really solve.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, we're being told time and time again as the film goes on, it's not Motown Records, mm-hmm. but it might as well be, becomes more corporate, that it's losing its soul. It's got no rhythm anymore. The music isn't as interesting as it used to
mm-hmm.
be. But that's all we're hearing.
Yeah.
And I just think that's fascinating. You also have the problem of Jennifer Hudson being, not only is she, as a performer, the most interesting person on screen, but that's who she is at the beginning of the film. That's what everyone is saying. She's
mm-hmm.
the voice.
Right.
She gets knocked out. We know that. The characters know that. And she disappears for half the
uh-huh.
film. These are problems that are being like explained and discussed in the film.
Right.
And are not resolved in the
yeah.
film. It's fascinating.
No, it is. It really is. And, you know, I thought, too, the way that the film dealt with, in this kind of music video way, unfortunately,
yeah.
history. We get all these
yeah.
moments of history, these riots in Detroit,
oof.
Martin Luther King. And although there is a funny joke about that
yes.
when Effie comes in with the record, you know, why is Martin Luther King on this label? That's funny. You know, I have to say I like that. But otherwise, it's just used as this tool and not really given any credence at all. It really just breezes through it. And, you know, I was watching these scenes. I feel sorry, though, maybe I shouldn't say that because I don't think he's that good in it, but I felt a little bit sorry for Jamie Foxx, actually, because I think he's a talented actor,
right.
and here I got really tired of watching him make the same face
oh,
over and over again. But he has to. He's put in these situations where, like, he has to just sit there and listen to other people sing at him.
Yeah, and then the camera's put on him. That's the director's
fault. And the camera's
put
on him, and how many ways can you react to that? And unfortunately, he has nothing to do. You know, one thing I did like about it, I will say, is that I love this moment when her mom, Dina's mom, says, you know, you're talking about my daughter like she's a product. And he says, a product. I like that. And what I did like about that is it could be really cynical and cold, but this is pre kind of, you know, branding and marketing and all that kind of selling out idea. So in a way, I mean, he's not being remotely ironic when he says that. He genuinely thinks, wow, that's great, a product, you know, and he takes that as a compliment. I thought that was actually kind of interesting, but there aren't enough interesting moments in the film. It's wall-to-wall music, and if you like the music, I think, you know, you'll probably like the film. I got tired of it.
I really did, too. And I think, too, that there's a point where I've never experienced this, certainly in any film we've seen this year, and certainly in no musical I've even
mm-hmm.
seen. I was genuinely blushing from embarrassment at how obviously some of these things were staged.
Yeah.
Like that we're family now.
Oh, yeah.
Or when they sort of tell her she's... I mean, you're right.
Yeah.
It's so on the nose. Not only the lyrics, but the way it's staged.
I know.
It's remarkable. But I will say, too, you mentioned Jamie Foxx. I think he has one of the nice scenes, too, that sort of has a hint of authenticity when he says to Beyoncé Knowles' character, you know why I picked you? Because your voice has no personality.
Right. I can
and
mold
it's such
you.
A jarring moment mm-hmm. of real conversation.
Yeah.
And the rest of the movie doesn't have it.
No, it doesn't.
All right. Well, if you've seen Dreamgirls and agree or disagree with our takes, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
It's time for a quick break. When we come back, Clint Eastwood presents the Japanese side of the Battle of Iwo Jima. And later in the show, we'll count down our top five performances of 2006. Stay with us.
If I could be a little bit younger, if I could be a little bit older, if I could be a little bit friendlier, if I could be a little bit colder, then I would be a little bit better. Yeah, I would be a little bit better. But I'm a middleman, stuck in the middle, right between anything tangible. Just a middleman, looking for a little, something that'll make me more radical. Well, it's the only thing been. That's been undeniable. That's a little man. Here I am, invisible but reliable. If I could be a little bit happier, if I could be a little more cranky.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight's guest of honor is from the Empire of Japan.
How would you feel if America and Japan were to enter war?
The United States is the last country in the world Japan should fight.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. With Sam Van Halgren, I'm Adam Kempinar. Letters from Iwo Jima is Clint Eastwood's companion piece to Flags of Our Fathers, which was released just a few months ago in October, and which we reviewed here on Chicago Public Radio. Flags tells the American side of the bloody month-long battle of Iwo Jima. Letters shows us the Japanese perspective. But the films are also different in their primary focus. Flags deals more with the soldiers' struggles back home, being treated as heroes and being used by the government's propaganda machine, while Letters is all about the battle itself. Unlike the American soldiers who landed on Iwo knowing there was a good chance they might die, the Japanese soldiers defended their island expecting to die, either at the hands of their enemy or by their own hands in shame. In saying we both liked Flags of Our Fathers for the way, mainly, that it revealed a part of American history we were just completely clueless about, but we were both put off by its clunky structure, overly reverential tone, and flat characters. I want to know whether or not Letters from Iwo Jima is a greater achievement, or is it similarly flawed?
Well, it turns out it's a greater achievement and similarly flawed.
Okay.
I mean, in addition to being an always relevant reminder that wars are fought by boys and very young men, and in our own time, young women, both films, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, have really interesting things to say, as you mentioned, about heroism and how a nation measures and values heroism. Flags of Our Fathers, like you said, shows how individual heroism was cynically commodified and promoted by the United States government for profit. Letters from Iwo Jima, Eastwood does explore the Japanese practice of suicide and self-sacrifice as acts of heroism and honor. And each film features a man who represents a critique of his nation's notion of heroism. And here's where I think Letters from Iwo Jima has a serious advantage. In Flags of Our Fathers, the movie's conscience is embodied by the utterly serious actor, Ryan Phillippe, as John Bradley, this humble small-town army medic who seethes under this overblown pomp and circumstance of the government's effort to exploit him and two other soldiers to sell war bonds. And I like Ryan Phillippe. I know a lot of people accuse him of being this boring, bland actor, but I think he's a totally solid actor. But in Flags, Philippe's seriousness makes for a pretty dull history lesson, I think we can agree with. And once you get Eastwood's point about American hypocrisy and cynicism, there's really not much else to it. I think we both thought there was a kind of redundancy to the message. Letters from Iwo Jima, on the other hand, is blessed with a conscience played by Ken Watanabe as General Tadamichi Kurabayashi, a Japanese general with this unorthodox idea about how to fight the Americans, but also how to die honorably, as they know they will. Watanabe is totally fascinating. He's eccentric and interesting. He's everything Philippe's everyman hero is not. And while Flags has to deal with the fact that there have been countless World War II movies with every character dynamic explored and every cliche about U.S. soldiers chronicled, Letters from Iwo Jima introduces us to this completely new group of soldiers, this new group of boys dying for their country, their concerns, their fears, their families, their daily routines, all totally new to me, totally fascinating. Watanabe's fascinating.
Yeah.
But again, and here's where I think Letters shares some of the same problems as Flags, that once Eastwood has made his point, is it really so honorable to end your life if your mission has failed, for example, as many of the Japanese soldiers do? Also, soldiers are all alike, no matter what you're fighting for and what is the point of war anyway. He keeps making it again and again. He made it in Flags. He makes it here in Letters. And I ended up wondering, you know, more than halfway through it, if the story could have been told in a single film more powerfully. But I don't have the answer to that.
No, I don't know. You know, I think that maybe Eastwood in this film goes a little bit too far in his humanist approach. I mean, I know some critics have questioned kind of this revisionist portrayal of the Japanese soldiers. They just aren't, you know, nearly as vicious, this vicious fighting force that history says apparently they were. And certainly Eastwood, you see, he goes out of his way to be fair. The Americans treat one prisoner we see in a scene very well. Another scene, we see them be extremely cruel. We see the Japanese do the exact same thing. There's one scene where they treat a prisoner with real care and respect. In an earlier scene, they're torturing a soldier. Maybe, you know, Eastwood tries a little too hard to show the similarities, like you talked about, between the American and Japanese, how soldiers are all soldiers. But my big problem with Flags, as I mentioned, was the structure. You know, this framing device of the son of Ryan Phillippe, or Ryan Phillippe, as I like to say, Sam, kind of researching his father's story, you know, that didn't work at all for me. And here there's a framing device as well, but it's much more subtle and not used nearly as much. And, you know, this idea where they start in the present day, we end in the present day, but instead of it being a distraction like it was in Flags, I actually found it quite moving. You know, I mean, I thought about Unforgiven, Eastwood's film, where, you know, he's acknowledging the story of the Western the whole time, you know, we're seeing it told or kind of rewritten throughout this film. There's a moment here where that same kind of thing is happening, where the same story that Eastwood's giving us, characters in the film, in a way, are discovering that story. It's kind of being discovered by the world. And I thought that was really fascinating. You know, there is a scene in here, though, that for me really reeked of Paul Haggis, who,
I know.
Who had the... He, apparently
he's
he didn't,
a plague on this movie.
I know. You know, he didn't... have a writing credit here, a screenwriting credit.
He's a co-story credit, I think.
A co-story, and there's one scene in particular where the Japanese have this scene where they get to know this American soldier they've taken prisoner.
The exact same scene I am.
Yeah, and you know, and it could be a really great scene, but it's just so heavy-handed, and it goes on so long, and we get this drippy dialogue of, my mother wrote me the same letters, and
well, that's the thing. We got it when he reads this letter, he interprets this letter.
And we can see their reactions.
Totally fine.
We don't need the characters to say it verbatim
right,
for
that's
us,
exactly
you know?
What my mother would write to me.
I know.
Oh,
it's
really?
Just,
great.
You're right. Some of the writing here, but you know, really, you touched on this. This is a war movie, and for me, seeing a war movie from the Japanese perspective, where the American soldiers are the ones being turned into that faceless
exactly.
nameless enemy, that was astonishing to me. Yeah. Really, I mean, and I was sucked in throughout the entire film, and you know, that cultural difference I touched on, where the, you know, the Americans are, you know, deep down. Any of those guys, they may hear from their commanding officers, you know, you're probably going to die at Iwo Jima, you know, such and such percentage of you aren't going to come back. And they may take that in. But do they really believe it? I think they probably go and they think, I'm going to be the lucky one. The guy next to me might die, but I'm going to get away. The Japanese actually went expecting to die.
Yeah.
Dying in battle was what they were supposed to do. And, you know, there's a scene in here, which is one of the most harrowing things I've ever seen on film, maybe, where these men take their own lives in shame because, you know, Mount Suribachi has fallen. And you know, really, you're watching that just in shock the entire time, thinking, how can this be possible? How can, instead of going to fight with the other men, you'd think that at least that would be more honorable, right, to go fight. You're still alive. You know, so you can still do something. And instead, they take their own lives just in a big circle. It's incredible. And really, for me then, watching this film from that perspective, it's kind of shocking that it hasn't really been done before. At least I'm not
totally
aware
agreed.
Of it.
I wanted to sort of make it a rule. It's like, before you make another American version of a World War II story, boy, there are a heck of a lot of other stories to tell from another perspective that are going to be fascinating just by the fact that you're doing them. And I thought there were some really nice, as much as we've seen war played out, the footage of war, putting you in the position of the soldiers, there were a couple new things that I think, you know, letters had that even flags didn't. And there was just a couple moments seeing from the ground eye view, seeing bombs fall from the sky or seeing the shadows of the bombs fall in the sky. That had an impact on me that no other kind of war footage has had recently, just because it's so punishing. Some of the punishing, you're lying on the ground with the Japanese soldiers, bullets are flying everywhere. We've seen that before, and it's interesting. I was so caught up in the story of the young boy, the young Japanese soldier, who's just not a soldier at all.
Saigo.
His story is so fascinating and interesting. It's so interesting to spend time with him and Watanabe's character that by the time we got to the battle, I realized I'd forgotten that the battle was about to come. I know everything is leading up to it, but I found myself almost kind of disappointed to have to go through what I knew I was going to go through. I just wanted to spend more time with these characters. And I think, so really, this first half of this film was really, really fascinating to me. And it was towards the end of the film where I realized that it still has this, like Flags, a kind of conventional structure, not just the bookended, what you're talking about, this kind of excavation of Mount Suribachi, which is, I think, fine and interesting and pretty unobtrusive. But this idea that we're introduced to these characters and they're going to have a kind of conventional arc. And that, again, is like Hollywood imposing itself, its rules on a movie that I think, you know, it's interesting just to spend time with these characters. But certain characters are identified as, we're following their story, and they're going to have certain parallel,
I mean, it's a war
ironic.
Movie.
It's a war
There's
movie.
A beginning, a and middle,
and
an end.
And I think it was just, I was reminded of that, and it disappointed me a little, because the really fascinating thing about this movie, and I think Eastwood does a great job with it, is really just, we're seeing another side of the war.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely there. And I think that, you know, there's a great moment, too, where one of the flashbacks that works really well is with this character, Saigo, who really doesn't want to go to war and isn't a soldier, as you said, and his wife is pregnant back at home, and when he has to say goodbye to his child, his unborn child, he's kind of making, you know, a humorous joke and talking to his wife, and they're talking about the fact that, you know, they know he's going to go and he's going to die is what they're expecting.
Yeah.
That was really moving and hard to watch for me, and I do agree with you as well that Ken Watanabe, who has been good in everything I've seen him in, he's really amazing here, and I think that what's great is not only, you know, Eastwood's patience and Watanabe's patience, because there's a moment where he's sitting for dinner with one of his officers, the Olympic champion. This guy was an Olympic champion.
Equestrian.
Equestrian. And there's a moment where they've already had one shot of whiskey, and it's really good stuff. And then the next time they take a drink. They're about to take another shot. And I noticed that Watanabe just pauses for a second just to kind of savor it before he takes the drink. And it's just one of these moments where it's like, pretty soon I'm going to be fighting a war. I'm not going to be around much longer. Yeah. I have to savor this and appreciate this taste for a second because I'm not going to get it again. I think that, you know, Eastwood, as a director, is able to allow those moments to happen because he just lets everything breathe and he's so patient and he isn't interested in kind of the quick cutting and the fast paced, you know, kind of war movie we're used to seeing. So it's also interesting too, I think, that both movies are about bureaucracy and they're about your leaders failing you. They are cynical in some way while at the same time being very humanist and hopeful in some ways. But I think it's just as cynical, if not more so, than Flags, because here people are dying for nothing. I mean, literally for nothing, rather than continue fighting, as we said.
There's no strategic advantage to holding that. It's a sacred kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I
think it's just the danger of patriotism is what he's talking about, too, and how that can be cynically used.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Well, I did really like it. And Letters from Iwo Jima is currently playing in New York and L.A. And actually, it's going to expand to Chicago and a few other markets on January 12th.
That's right. When Film Spotting returns, your chance at a free DVD in Massacre Theater and the 5 best performances by an actress in 2006. We used to kiss, we used to hold hands, we never did make any plans. Day to day was the best that you could do. There wasn't much for me to say.
You hear about this guy who swallowed a yo-yo?
Swallowed a yo-yo?
Yeah, on a bed. Some clodhopper down in Griffith, Indiana.
Boy, they write the silliest things in the newspapers.
What do you mean, silly? I mean, that's real news. That's not like a politics slot.
What is the name of the Lone Ranger's nephew's horse?
Victor. His name is Victor.
How the hell did you know that?
Everybody knows that.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. With Sam Van Halgren, I'm Adam Kempinar. It's time for Massacre Theater.
A very special Massacre Theater.
Yes, it is. The part of the show where we absolutely ruin a good film, and you get a shot at a free DVD. For official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Last week on the Film Spotting podcast, Adam and I massacred the scene you heard coming out of the break from holiday classic A Christmas Story, a tie-in with Christmas, of course. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
I loved how many people wrote in, Sam, saying, I didn't know this line, but I was watching it over the holidays after listening to your show, and I knew it, so I had to email. The winner is Walt Seigen from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Congratulations, Walt. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
Betty.
Yeah, Betty. Look, you don't rush it. I don't rush it. Okay? Now, we're going to play this nice and close. Just like in the movies, okay?
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And Sam, it's the end of the year. It's a big show. We thought, why not bring
guests.
In some guests? Yeah. So this is a first in the history of Film Spotting. We actually have a four-person scene.
Yeah.
We've had three before.
It could get unwieldy.
It could. It could. I've had to already do some directing in our rehearsals. But let's go ahead
and
welcome
talent.
In. I know.
You're in the wrong field.
I really am. Let's welcome in our guests, Sam. We have the guy who has been mentioned a few times on our show, really is responsible for Film Spotting
right,
in many ways.
Us.
The guy who introduced us, my college roommate, Kevin Rich, a professional actor. Kevin, thank you.
It's all my fault. I apologize.
Yeah, it is your fault. And also we have here, Sam, someone else who's been mentioned quite a few times
That's
on the
right.
show, but no one's really got to hear her except in an outtake, and that is...
my wife.
Your wife.
Carrie Van Halgren.
Carrie.
That's right. And we have to say, Kevin also responsible for introducing my wife and I.
That's correct. Before you even met your wife, I saw Kevin and Carrie act in a play together. So they've been, you know, old pros
magic.
At this.
That's
it
right.
is magic. So let's go ahead and do this scene again. This is tying in with our top five. We're going to get to top five performances of the year. So the only clue really is just think of actors or actresses that are getting a lot of Oscar buzz, a lot of buzz around awards time. And this is a movie that one of those people starred in.
Good
safe
enough.
To say.
That's
okay,
right.
So are we ready to get started?
That's right. So you're going to start, so I'm going to give you the action.
Okay.
And action.
Blank, have you decided which hospital you want to work at here in New Orleans?
Well, to be quite honest, I'm thinking about getting back into law.
Oh, my. Are you a doctor or a lawyer?
Before I went to medical school, I passed the bar in California. I practiced law for 1 year, and then I decided, why not try my hand at pediatrics?
You're just full of surprises.
Yeah.
Oh, my. A doctor and a lawyer. Well, I'd say the blank hit the jackpot.
Where'd you go to law school?
Berkeley.
Berkeley? Berkeley? Oh, my gosh. Isn't that where you went, Daddy?
Maybe Frank could come work for you, Blank. You're always saying how hard it is to find assistant prosecutors.
Could he, Daddy? Could he? Please? Could he come work with you, please?
And scene.
Nicely done.
Really nicely done.
Really nicely done, yes. Great stuff there.
We have raised the bar here for Massacre Theater.
Okay, well, if you know what film the four of us just massacred, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the next episode of the weekly Film Spotting podcast. To listen, just go to filmspotting.net.
Well, I certainly have nothing to say to her. And why should I approve of his cavorting with a harlot?
Your Royal Highness.
Well, that's what she is. Everyone knows that she's from a brothel and that title was bought for her.
It is only what I have been told by others. They tell us the world will line up and reveal we are on the right path.
You know what they call you?
What?
The prom king.
Oh, God. Really?
Yeah, they mean it as a compliment. You're a big character in their fantasy lives.
Olive, Uncle Frank didn't really have an accident. What happened was he tried to kill himself.
You did?
Sam, it's the end of the year. We are shining the spotlight on some of our favorite performances right. of the year. We're going to do actors here in the next segment, but right now it's time for our favorite female performances. We heard a few of them there that didn't make the list, actually, didn't make our top fives, but some other performances that we both really liked.
You if you weren't able
share
to, yeah,
who those
pick
were?
Those out. That was Kristen Dunst in Marie Antoinette, Bryce Dallas Howard in Lady in the Water, Kate Winslet in Little Children, and Toni Collette from Little Miss Sunshine. All, again, performances we really liked, but just didn't make the top five. We've got five more here each.
Mm-hmm.
That are even better.
Yes, except for the fact that I may actually have to bump my number five out and put Carrie Van Halgren.
Boy, that
for
was
her
outstanding
Massacre
work. Yeah. Can you see now why I married her?
I can, actually. Thank Absolutely. You. Okay, well, let's get to our top five list. Sam, you kick it off with your number five.
I'm starting with Helen Mirren's performance as Queen Elizabeth II. I think you may be asking yourselves, wait a minute, are you doing this list in reverse? Helen Mirren has been praised as giving one of the greatest performances of the year so far in The Queen, and as good as Mirren is, great actress, I totally agree with that general consensus. There is something kind of cold and clinical about her performance. There isn't. Mirren completely conveys the sense of regal reserve. And again, I know that Queen Elizabeth isn't this font of emotion. Mm-hmm. I mean, but again, I think there's a precision to Mirren's performance that, again, is par excellence mm-hmm. technical acting, but didn't excite me in a way that I think the four other names on my list did.
That's great. So this is Sam Van Halgren's top five backhanded performances
backhanded
of the year.
Backhanded compliments. She received enough, you know, straight-ahead compliments. Let's
give me
her
a break. I'm gonna name her number five, but I didn't really like the performance.
You'll see next time Mirren's out there. She's just going to be just raw.
Okay.
Raw.
We will see. Well, my number five, Sam, I never thought I'd say this name in a top five anything, and that is Gretchen Mol from the notorious Betty Page, a movie we didn't get to review on our show, but we both have caught up with. And, you know, she has to play this character in Betty Page, a Southern girl who has to be naive and innocent without being dumb, and she really pulls that off. We have to respect her. And she spends the bulk of the movie performing for the camera within the camera, the still photos being taken of her, modeling, and somehow she makes every time she does it look like the first time she's done it. There is a joy in her performing for that camera. And we see the real Betty Page just for 20 or 30 seconds at the end of the film. And really, I was just in awe how Gretchen Mol captured that joy that Betty Page had. It's dead on. It really is one of my favorite performances. Obviously, my number five.
He's hurt right now. He's feeling pretty bad. He's going to go out there and he's going to get drunk. He's going to make a complete fool of himself, and he will be sitting there feeling pretty lonely and pretty pathetic, and then it's just going to hit him.
What's going to hit him?
That not only is he out a girlfriend, but his life is just falling apart piece by piece.
Oh, dear. I may have lost all credibility. Helen Mirren, number five. Jennifer Aniston in The Breakup.
I love it.
Number four. That scene that I just played, I admit, doesn't sound too much unlike you may have heard Jennifer Aniston exchange, or an exchange you may have heard on Friends say, but I think her performance in The Breakup, like the film itself, was one of the biggest surprises of the year. That is something we agree on.
Mm-hmm.
And what did I say about Mirren's performance of Suggest? It's smart, specific, but cold and a little clinical. Aniston has some of the most moving scenes in any film this year. And yes, The Breakup is a comedy, but I talked about Mirren being raw in the future, and I know she has been.
Yes,
I know she's
certainly
a great actress. Please don't take me out of context. But there are a couple scenes in this film that are absolutely real and honest and emotional, and Aniston totally makes them work. She's great. And she's funny, too. And I think what could be, you know, a really conventional wet blanket kind of role,
mm-hmm.
Opposite Vince Vaughn's charmingly dense kind of boyfriend, she really makes real and totally sympathetic, and I really liked her.
I agree. I liked her performance a lot, too. We both liked that film. Well, I'd love to play a clip, Sam, from my number four performance, but it's in Korean, so I can't really do that. But I am actually picking here, and I apologize to anyone who, you know, knows that I'm butchering this name, but it's Lee Young-ai for playing the kind-hearted Lee Goom-ja in the final chapter of Park Chan-wook's revenge trilogy, Lady Vengeance. And she's playing, really, in this film, what I love about it, she's playing a role within a role, since her character, as I said, she's kind of known as the kind-hearted one, and everyone thinks of her as this model prisoner that she's playing. She wants to get out of jail. She's been in prison for 13 years for kidnapping and murdering a young boy, but all she has is revenge on her mind. She's going to get out and get her vengeance on the person who is really responsible for that murder. And she really is just fantastic because she's so sweet and innocent and then has this dark side that she can just flip on, and it takes you totally by surprise. So a great film and a great performance by Lee Young-ai.
All right, number three, I think maybe one of the best young actresses working today, Evan Rachel Wood, her performance in Down in the Valley, a film we disagreed on, I know. But again, here's a part where any other film or any other actress could really, it would be a run-of-the-mill teenage wild child, one-dimensional rebellion. This is the object of Ed Norton's obsession in this film, this West Coast take on Taxi Driver. And she makes it completely and utterly real. Not only do you understand what Ed Norton's character finds so fascinating about her, but she's fully realized as well as a teenager who's caught between a father who doesn't really know how to be a father and somebody who is finally paying her some attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's remarkable, and she's one of these actresses that whatever she's doing, I'm interested.
Yeah, no, I think she's great in that film as well. My number three, another one I can't really play a clip from because it's in a foreign language, and that is Penelope Cruz as Raymunda in Pedro Almodovar's Volver. Really, I think Cruz shows here that she's the perfect Almodovar muse because she has to alternate really fluidly between comedy and drama. This melodramatic tone that Almodovar has in all of his films, she just nails it perfectly. She can't play the comedy too broad, but she can't go too far into soap opera territory either and make it too dramatic and heavy, you know, so where we walk in and all of a sudden we see a scene and think we're in a completely different theater or a completely different movie. She just nails it, and the film somehow feels consistent throughout, I think, despite those shifts in tone, largely because of Cruz's performance. She's really fun to watch here, and kind of a revelation considering all the films she's made here in the
right
States that have been mostly forgettable.
Yeah.
Here, she's just a treat to watch.
Well, I'm playing by everyone else's rules here by making Meryl Streep's brilliant performances, Miranda Priestley in The Devil Wears Prada, elite performances, because it actually is, and I think we agree here, Adam, it's the best supporting performance by an actress this year. Let's just hear a little clip.
I asked for clean, athletic, smiling. She sent me dirty, tired, and paunchy. An RSVP, yes, the Michael Kors party. I want the driver to drop me off at 9:30 and pick me up at 9:45 sharp. Then call Natalie at Gloria's Foods and tell her no for the 40th time. No, I don't want duck wise. I want torts filled with warm rhubarb compote. Then call my ex-husband and remind him that parent-teacher conference is at Daltner tonight. And then call my husband, ask him to please meet me for dinner at that place I went to with Massimo. Also, tell Richard I saw all the pictures that he sent for that feature on the female paratroopers. And they're all so deeply unattractive. Is it impossible to find a lovely, slender female paratrooper?
No.
Am I reaching for the stars here?
No.
Not really.
I know you, Adam, consider this performance a cliche. What it is an acting clinic. And it's just another reminder that Streep is the best at what she does.
That's all you have to say?
That's all I have to say.
End of story, period.
That's right. Everyone else has seen it. You've seen the clips. You're going to see clips upon clips for the Oscars she's inevitably going to be nominated for.
Well, you're simplifying my take on it a little bit. When we discuss the film on the show, actually, I praise
But I think what I want to say is praise the film, too, for giving her interesting things to say.
Okay.
And I think you can hear that in the clip I played.
Even though, for the most part, she's Cruella de Vil. Okay. Well,
you always have to have the last
I
word.
I do. I have to have the last word, don't I? Let's get on to my number two, and let's hear a clip.
You obviously know my job better than I do.
Yes, well, you are my 10th Prime Minister, Mr. Blair.
My first, of course, was Winston Churchill. He sat in your chair in frock coat and top hat. He was kind enough to give a shy young girl like me quite an education.
I can imagine.
With time, one has hopefully added experience to that education and a little wisdom, better enabling us to execute our constitutional responsibility.
Well, you were wrong in your description of Helen Mirren. You were wrong in only putting her at number five as Queen Elizabeth II in The Queen. She's fantastic. She's not nearly as cold and clinical as you think she is. And that scene I love, that's the first scene with Helen Mirren and Michael Sheen as Tony Blair, where she's welcoming him as he's just taken office. It's their first meeting together. And I love how disarming and funny she can be without ever, throughout the film, mugging for the camera. And she lets him know his place without making her intent explicit, without, you know, kind of putting too fine a point on it. It's like, you know, I had Winston Churchill as a prime right. minister, okay? And, you know, right away what she's trying to get across with that. And I think it would have been so easy for Helen Mirren to play this role with a wink, to play it a little ironically, sure. like, you know, of course Queen Elizabeth is this doddering
it's
old
this
fool.
Iconic character.
She's totally
sure,
out of
yeah.
touch. But right. she doesn't, because Stephen Frears and Mirren
That's
both,
how you would have played it, Adam. I know.
Exactly,
yeah.
I know. But Frears, I think, and Mirren, they both have so much respect for her that I think is really nice to see. And, you know, Mirren, you talked about this, how she has been raw in other performances. Certainly she has. But she's such a sexy, kind of catty actress. And here she sublimates all of that to play this stuffy, old-fashioned woman. But it made me think of something you said, Nicolas Cage in World Trade
yeah,
Center.
Good point.
A great male performance, how he takes all his charisma and kind of takes it down a notch
and
to be a simple guy.
And that makes this normal guy electric
right,
somehow,
but still
yeah.
it has something underneath it. I always felt like that Helen Mirren energy and charisma was always bubbling underneath
right.
the surface of Queen Elizabeth. There was always, you know, some passion, some intelligence there. I love the performance. It's my number two.
And I'm going to have the last word here. My number one is not Helen Mirren.
Okay.
The opposite of, no.
You got
it
me.
It is actually somebody you already mentioned, and it is Gretchen Mol as Betty Page in The Notorious Betty Page. And I think of all the movies I've mentioned so far, they would have suffered from a bad performance by another actress and are made better by how good their performances are. But without the performance of Gretchen Mol as Betty Page, this movie doesn't work at all. Mol's Page is not just the central character. Her persona permeates the entire film, this blissfully innocent girl caught up in this softcore porn industry of the 1950s. The entire experience of the movie is predicated on our understanding of how Betty Page sees the world as this innocent.
Yeah.
And the film is really interesting, and I think we'd love to talk about it at some point. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's like an Ed Wood film in some way, this 1950s B picture,
yeah.
Sort of in the spirit of the art she's involved in. And it is her innocence that just shatters the illusion of anything perverted or dirty. I think it's a phenomenal performance. Like you said, it's completely uncanny. And I think her performance makes the film as interesting as it is.
From the age of 16 to 22, heroin was the love of my life. I mean, I had a daughter and I never even took care of her. And I want to take care of her. But I gotta stay clean, so I'm just here to stay clean. And
well, that's a clip from my favorite performance of the year, and it is Sam, Maggie Gyllenhaal as Sherry in the film Sherry, Baby. She was my favorite supporting actress of 2006, and now she's my favorite actress as well. We've already debated this film somewhat in the dope sheet. Heatedly in our email newsletter, but this is one of those roles that seems to have Oscar written all over it for a woman, because it's kind of like Charlize Theron with Monster, Halle Berry in Monster's Ball, where we have a beautiful actress playing ugly and also getting naked.
Yeah.
And you kind of wonder, is that really so brave? Well, you know what? I think yes, actually. I think it might be. I think just doing some of the things she does literally on screen might be braver than what we see Meryl Streep do in Devil Wears Prada, but that's a debate for another time. But honestly, what I respect so much about this performance is the way she exposes herself emotionally and her willingness to play someone with really no redeeming characteristics at all. She's her own worst enemy throughout. She constantly undermines herself and any sympathy we have for her. I think it's a difficult film, difficult performance, and yet I think she's very understated in it. I absolutely believed her as this character throughout. I obviously am a big Maggie Gyllenhaal fan. I know you are too.
I am too.
I like this performance more than you, apparently.
All right. Well, time for one last quick break. When we come back, the five best performances by an actor in 2006. Stay with us.
I'm here at your party, trying not to hurt, in my melancholy trousers and my masochistic shirt. Hope I don't look awkward.
doing all I could do to avoid the shade of blue on my best foot forward shoe. Happy anniversary, I see you're doing fine. If I say I am, I'm lying, 'cause I wish you were still mine. Happy anniversary, I see you're doing fine. If I say I am, I'm lying, 'cause I wish you were still mine. Wish you were still mine.
Hello, Film Spotting podcast listeners. Adam and I wanted to share a quick note about the all-new PeerFlix.com. Among the enhancements you'll find to the site, PeerFlix has converted the PeerBucks credit system to trade cash. Now, when you send DVDs, you'll earn trade cash, and you can use this trade cash to receive DVDs from other members, or once you have $100, you can cash out. You get $100.
That's it.
Okay.
Up to $250. Plus, check out the new PeerFlix online community with new features to let you interact with other movie fans. Just complete your profile, upload an avatar to personalize it, create a group to discuss your favorite flicks, or write a review to tell the world how wrong Sam was for liking American Dreams.
Completely unfair. How about your love for Casino Royale? I'm alone on American Dreams, aren't I?
You totally are alone. Completely alone. Right. Discover, trade, and connect at PeerFlix.com.
A fun place to get movies for less.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. We want to take a quick minute to thank Bottle Rockets and Chicago's own Bloodshot Records for today's music, music from their 2006 release, Zoysia. We're in the midst of our countdown of the best performances of the year. In our last segment, we discussed our favorite actresses of the year. A quick recap here, Sam, for any new listeners.
That's right.
Your performances, number 5, Helen Mirren in The Queen. Number 4, Jennifer Aniston in The Breakup. Number 3, Evan Rachel Wood from Down in the Valley. Number 2, Meryl Streep, The Devil Wears Prada. And number 1, another kind of surprise, Gretchen Mol from The Notorious Betty Page.
Yeah, and you had actually Gretchen Mol in The Notorious Betty Page as your number 5. Then Lee Young I in Lady Vengeance. Penelope Cruz in Volver. Helen Mirren in The Queen at number 2. And number 1, yes, Maggie Gyllenhaal in Cherry Baby.
And I wanted to come up with a story that would demonstrate qualities that I'm sure you all admire here, like earnestness or diligence and team playing to something, and I couldn't think of anything. So the truth is, I was arrested for failure to pay parking tickets.
Parking tickets?
And I ran all the way here from the Polk station, the police station.
What were you doing before you were arrested?
I was painting my apartment.
That's Will Smith making the pitch that saves his life, arriving unkempt at his internship interview with the top brass at Dean Witter. And the scene honestly doesn't really show the depth and honesty of Smith's portrayal of the real-life Chris Gardner. What it does show is the familiar charm of Will Smith, but Smith and the movie is full of honesty as it brings to life Chris Gardner's desperation to make a better life for himself and his son. And really every single moment in this film, I think, with Will Smith and his son is full of that kind of honesty, sincerity, and genuineness that really surprised me in the
film. Yeah, no, I agree. I liked his performance a lot as well. Didn't quite make my cut, though. My number 5 is an actor we both love, and that's Clive Owen as Theo in Alfonso Cuarón's film Children of Men. I think Owen also deserves some recognition for his fun performance in Spike Lee's Inside Man earlier in the year as well. But, you know, Clive Owen is one of these guys who could play Bond. He can play this suave, kind of flashy hero. And here he is an everyman. And we've seen him be a great everyman in a lot of films. And here he's just a guy going through his bleak, boring life in this future setting where women can't reproduce. There are no more babies. And everyone knows that eventually the human race is going to die out. And, you know, if the movie on some level, I think, tries to redeem him or provide some hope, I don't think that he, Owen, or Cuarón as the director overplay that. And, you know, there's one scene in this film where you get to just watch him listening to Michael Caine explaining how Theo, Clive Owen's son, died. And you know at some point you're going to hear the story behind this. And just watching Clive Owen listen to that scene is one of the best scenes in the film, I think. So really a great performance in a really good film that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet. But hopefully on an upcoming show we will.
My number 4, I talked about Evan Rachel Wood's performance in Down in the Valley. The counterpart performance, Ed Norton's performance in this film, is just as good, even better, in fact. And I know it's a film we fought over. Mm-hmm. And we fought over Norton in the over this year, his performance in The Illusionist.
Yeah, which I liked.
Yeah, but I've accused, and I think I did accuse him in The Illusionist, of being a kind of exhibiting a kind of anti-charisma as an acting choice in some way. I know I've been critical of him, but I think in this film, yes, that is very derivative of Scorsese's Taxi Driver. In fact, there is a scene where it is blatantly ripping off Taxi Driver. Mm-hmm. We get Ed Norton staring menacingly into a mirror with a gun. I still think the film is really imaginative and a really interesting new filmmaker, and Ed Norton, I think, is the most kind of liberated in some way too, and fully formed. I just loved his performance in this film, but it was just part of a film that I really loved.
Okay, well, here's another film, Sam, for my number four that we split on, and I love this pick because I know you're going to really not be able to stand it, and that is actually Daniel Craig, Casino Royale.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not.
You're doing this for me alone.
I am. I mentioned James Bond.
I can't
believe
it.
That Clive Owen could have played Bond.
All the performances.
You know what? The new Bond is perfect. Daniel Craig in Casino Royale. He deserves to be on this list, and as high as he is at number four, because he did something I thought was impossible, which is to take a character and a franchise and make them both relevant again. And he hits all the right notes as Bond with those witty bits of dialogue, the witty banter, yet, you know, he also really brings out Bond's brutality and shows a dark side to him. There's a complexity to Daniel Craig that other people that might have played Bond or other people that have played Bond don't bring to it. And, you know, now Bond, the producers, by getting Craig and with this film, they've done the easy part, I think. You know, starting over, I think, is easy to do. They can reinvent Bond. Now they're going to have to show us something more. They got to show that they can actually keep it relevant.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they can or not, but I'll be watching. And a big reason why is because of Daniel Craig.
You're going to look back on this list with embarrassment.
Nope.
All right. My number three is Forrest Whitaker, The Last King of Scotland. This is simply, I think, and I love hyperbole, but I think this is one of the greatest performances of all time. Why is it then at number three?
Yes, why?
Because it's a supporting role,
okay,
first of all, in a deeply flawed film.
No.
Yes.
No.
It has a lot of problems, not the least of which being the most interesting character, that is Idi Amin, played by Forrest Whitaker, is made into this second fiddle, and sort of disappears and becomes less interesting as the film does in the second half. And so it's number three, and I think there are two better performances in terms of what they have to do in their films. But Forrest Whitaker, I don't want it to go unsaid. It's one of the greatest performances, certainly this year. It's a phenomenal performance.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and hear a clip from my number three.
It's dialectics. Can I talk to you?
What's up?
Okay, look. I hate to be this guy right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I need you to stay away from Dre.
Excuse me?
You heard me, okay? So just do me this solid, all right, man? Please.
Do you solid?
You know what I'm saying. You understand
me. Oh, so this like stay away from the girl, she's too precious kind of shit?
I'm not kidding.
Oh, I know.
So you understand?
That's Ryan Gosling as Dan Dunn in a scene with Anthony Mackie, another great actor who had a really good year with We Are Marshall and this film, playing the drug dealer Frank. But really, these two characters kind of bartering for the soul of one of Dan's students, Sharika Epps, in a performance I know you loved on your top five supporting actress list. And I think that scene really captures what makes Gosling's performance so good throughout, which is the spontaneity of it. Really, you get the sense throughout the entire film that this is truly a guy making it up as he goes along, and also really captures the guilt, which I think this film, in large part, is about guilt and explores it in an interesting way, where he's a guy who is aware of his own hypocrisy, wants so bad to reach these students, and yet he realizes that he's not, necessarily good at his job or isn't as good as he wants to be
or
at getting through
yeah,
or could sure. be because of his own limitations and own demons. And I think Gosling is just phenomenal in this film.
Well, it's a perfect segue. My number two is Ryan Gosling, Dan Dunn, and Half Nelson. I mean, one of the reasons I go to the movies is to see great acting. And great acting, by great acting, I mean those people that really have an extra gear, whether it's an emotional gear or whatever. There's something that you're seeing. They're better able to create the illusion that real life is unfolding on screen. As you said, you're right. You see him making decisions every single moment. You think at every moment he's going to turn his life around or make a decision that's going to surprise you. The performance is so good, I may be unable to know exactly how good the film is because he makes the film better or certainly great.
So, do they all come in here and cry, your cops?
Sometimes they do. Yeah, sure. Sometimes they cry, yeah. If they've had trouble at home, if they've had to use their weapons.
Use their weapons? Let me tell you something. They signed up to use their weapons. most of them, all right? But they watch enough TV so they know they have to weep after they use their weapons. There is no one more full of shit than a cop, except for a cop on TV.
Honestly, Sam, after rewatching the scene we just played earlier today, I almost ended up putting this guy up at number one because I enjoyed watching that scene and this performance so much, and that is Leonardo DiCaprio as Billy Costigan in The Departed. I have to say, I mentioned this during our review of The Departed, I really go into every DiCaprio movie expecting him not to be good, and yet he always is good. You know, I was really worried here that I didn't think he could pull off the mature nature of the character and really have something deep and kind of devious and dark underneath the surface the way Tony Leung does in Infernal Affairs, the film it's based on. And I was constantly amazed throughout this entire film. The way he takes Vera Farmiga apart in that scene we just heard, the psychiatrist he's talking to, it's great dialogue, without a doubt, but his conviction is what sells that, and his timing. And, you know, he's a guy throughout this entire film dealing with an identity crisis, and he would just be impossible to read because of his performance, the way Vera Farmiga, her character in that scene, can't read him. And, you know, on top of it all, I have to give DiCaprio some credit because he's a total badass in this film. You know, I mean, you just don't know from moment to moment how he's going to react in a given scene. And, you know, what's fun is that you can tell that he hates what he's doing, what he's going through, having to play this criminal, and yet on some level he embraces it. He knows that it is a part of him. I think just throughout the film, DiCaprio, as I said, just blew me away. I loved watching this film for a lot of reasons, but he was a big reason why it was maybe the most fun I had at the theater this year.
No, it's a great point. All right, well, Forest Whitaker, one of the greatest performances of all time. Ryan Gosling, a great Pantheon performance. What could be number one?
Hi. Welcome back to another episode of Télévision Éducative. Tonight, I'll show you how dreams are prepared. People think it's a very simple and easy process, but it's a bit more complicated than that. As you can see, a very delicate combination of complex ingredients is the key. First, we put in some random thoughts, and then we add a little bit of reminiscences of the day.
What is Gael Garcia Bernal as Stefan and Michel Gondry's The Science of Sleep doing as my number one performance by an actor in 2006? And I equate it to being a bit like the degree of difficulty criteria that judges use for the high dive in the Olympic Games. Gondry's movie is this personal expression of his own intricate fantasy world, and whoever was tasked with the role of Stefan would be asked to play by this whole new set of emotional rules, this young man who's never quite sure if he's awake or asleep and dreaming, and Garcia Bernal just makes this film work. He makes it his own. He finds a great, great partner with Michel Gondry, and the movie makes sense because he makes sense of it in every single moment. I think it's a phenomenal performance. And really, it's up to Bernal to guide us through the logic that Gondry has laid out. And I can't imagine anyone else playing the role.
Good to see you again, Dr. Kerrigan.
You too.
You see, Jonah, this is the sort of man a president needs around him. Someone who is not afraid to speak his mind.
So, what do you say, Nicholas? Will you take the job?
But I'm sorry, you want me to be your physician?
Do you want to be of service to Uganda, Dr. Garrigan?
Yes, I do.
Then what better way than to look after the health?
Supporting performance or not, Sam, you say Forrest Whitaker's turn as Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland is one of the best performances, certainly, of the year. I agree. In fact, it's the best performance of the year by an actor, and I agree with you. He should be a supporting actor, technically. You know, I love James McAvoy, who is technically the lead in this film, I think, but really, Whitaker gives a towering performance in one of my favorite films of the year, Unlike You. I love this film, and I think I described him during our review as this kind of teddy bear. He plays Amin like this teddy bear that's really cute and cuddly one minute, but you know that at any second he's got this potential to maul you. And the anticipation, kind of like with DiCaprio, with Gosling, I noticed these kind of themes reoccurring where what I liked about their performances is that there's an anticipation to seeing in every moment how that character is going to react. You just don't know. There's a wild card kind of nature to it, and it brings tension to every scene he's in. And there is so much charisma that you see, absolutely, how he captivated a nation and seduced this main character. I'm telling you, I played part of it there in that scene where he's recruiting Nicholas Garrigan to be his doctor, his personal physician. I would probably do anything Idi Amin asked me to do just based on Whitaker's performance. He's that seductive.
Or certainly Forrest Whitaker as Idi Amin. Maybe not Idi Amin himself.
Probably not.
I just want to give you a little credit.
Okay.
All right, well, that is our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Next week on the podcast, we'll review The Good German, We Are Marshall, and also Bobby, the Emilio Estevez film that got a Golden Globe nomination. We'll spend a few minutes on that. And then on January 10th, we'll devote our entire show to our year in review. We'll count down our top 10 films of 2006.
This edition of Film Spotting is presented by Chicago Public Radio with editorial assistance from Christina Stevens and Joe Dassault. Our thanks again to Bottle Rockets and Bloodshot Records for today's music. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Happy New Year, and thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Discover, trade, connect at PeerFlix.com. And by StompThePodcast.com. Join urban podcaster Tony Costas as he gives you the inside track to stomp culture and life. Discover Stomp's evolution firsthand from urban Greek fraternity members. Go behind the scenes to find out what makes Stomp street-style dance shows a riveting experience. And meet the cast members from Stomp the Yard in theaters January 12th. With exclusive interviews and a live event from the red carpet, step up to Stomp culture and life, all at StompThePodcast.com.